Let's go around, say names.
Did you crack his name?
Domio?
Domio.
Drew?
Drew.
Jinryu.
Jinryu.
Jula.
Jula.
Amy.
Amy.
Myoju.
Myoju.
Bob.
Bob.
Sam.
Sam.
Ruthann.
Ruthann.
Richard.
Richard.
Frank.
Frank.
Kathy.
Kathy.
Mara.
Mara.
Joan.
Joan.
David.
David.
Mark.
Mark.
Stephanie.
Stephanie.
Jill.
Jill.
Phil.
Phil.
Sam.
Coming in very briefly.
Okay, so in terms of announcements, for this Saturday, that is the 13th, is the potluck, the summer potluck, and we have a if I'm not mistaken, we have about 40 people coming.
Wow.
Ooh, that's wow. Great.
Well, except if some people drop out. But that's okay. And then the next day we have Rinzan from Nomrang Sendo is coming to do Dharma Talk. That's on the 14th. And the 20th is the book group. And 27th is the poetry group. That's all the announcements I have. If you have any more,
One, if you don't mind walking, just remember that you can park up that gravel road instead of coming down to the parking lot. Or you can, if you get here early, come down to the parking lot, turn around, and then come and drive. Park on the driveway. To this side toward the building. And if you're the first car, you can pull like pretty much all the way up to the top and then people can park behind you. And that way we extend the length of time that it's viable for us to use this building, because as you know, we have a very small parking lot. It gets kind of awkward. So I personally prefer to park up that gravel road. But if you do need to park closer to the door, by all means. Also, if anybody has a little dog, these are little dental chews that Suka had tummy problems, so she would put on a strict diet. So anyway,
can Curly eat them?
Hey, yeah, they're kind of small and non-consequential to him.
But they wouldn't be good treats.
Yeah, they do. They good treats.
I wanted to say that some people, one person was having trouble registering for the...
Oh, yes. There's something wrong with the registration form. I just updated the software on the website for the forms, so it's probably not working. So hopefully somebody's going to remind me of that tomorrow, and I will fix it. So if it's not just you, if you find you can't register. All right. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So today, beginning our study of this book, Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. And I'm going to present the main points of, it's actually the introduction and the first chapter. And as I do, I'm going to essentially answer the question. I mean, it's all lovely and everything, but I'm going to say, you know, what does each point have to do with Buddhism? And bring in some Buddhist practices and teachings that relate. And thought I would also pass these around. Pass that up, and Andrew, could you pass that the other direction?
Thank you.
Oh, I just have to keep one. I guess I just found myself, as I was preparing for this class today, this just came out of me. These four premises of this course on active hope. So this is where I'm starting from as I present this, and I'm not saying that you have to agree, but I don't know. This is where I'm hoping we can kind of start from, and then it will frame the kinds of conversations that we have. So I will just go over this. We are in a climate and ecological emergency. We may believe different things about the likelihoods and timelines regarding such things as global warming, ecological collapse, mass extinctions, widespread shortages of food and water, sea level rise, mass migration, life-threatening pollution, an increased frequency and severity of natural disasters like flooding, wildfires, and storms. However, the situation is already dire for many people around the world, and the only question is whether privileged lives in wealthy countries will be impacted significantly within our lifetime, or the lifetime of our children, or our grandchildren. So this course will not be about all that stuff that's going on. Will not be making the case for that kind of emergency. I don't know where you are in coming to terms with that, or accepting that, or believing that. But I don't know. I don't know what your news sources are, but I know mine are very, very full of this every day. So let's kind of starting from that. Two, the time has come to shift the focus from green consumerism to working for systemic change. Our personal choices matter, and we are bound by our consciences to inform ourselves and minimize the harm we do the planet and other living beings. However, decades of focus on voluntary green consumerism has not had anywhere near the impacts that have been achieved by changes in laws and regulations. In addition, feelings of guilt or inadequacy about how green we are can keep us from taking action. And debates about these issues divide us just when we need to be working on solidarity. We need to let go of our preoccupation with green consumerism when we're together and learn to talk about our concerns for the earth in broader terms. Again, you may disagree, but I know I am not that interested anymore in conversations about kind of competing for who's the purest in terms of green living. We all know that our ecological footprints in general as Americans are huge, and we need to think about these things, and it's not at all to take these things lightly, but I found it very interesting when I read an article recently about, it was written by this environmentalist who just said, "I don't care if you recycle, if you want to be part of my movement, I welcome you." I mean, it's just, you know, like we have to get together to work for systemic change and just leave some of this stuff, stop focusing only on that stuff. She mentioned in there something about the Crying Indian campaign of the early 70s, and I had to go look it up, what that was. And apparently, some of you will remember, I'm sure, there were these, you know, don't litter public service messages with an Indian who's, you know, looking at the trash, and turns out it wasn't a real Indian, you know, whatever. But anyway, he's crying, and, you know, and then everybody was like, you know, you shouldn't litter. But the whole thing was paid for and designed by beverage companies that were moving away from reusable containers to like aluminum and stuff like that. So they were kind of shifting the focus away from people trying to fight that and trying to keep them using reusable containers, just shift the focus onto it's your problem because you're littering. Mm. So that's like all along this kind of it's a very clever deflection from the systemic stuff, from the corporations and the governments and the corruption that is behind the worst part of this, and then we're just all still concerned about, you know, our personal lives. Not saying that's not important, but three, our spiritual practice compels us to act for the welfare of all beings, and such action is inseparable from our spiritual practice. So spiritual and religious traditions throughout time, including Buddhism, have had an otherworldly focus, providing people with solace and peace even though this world is deeply flawed. While it is not helpful to tie our happiness to achieving particular results in the world, mature spiritual traditions recognize that our inner peace is not separate from the well-being of all life. So Jesus gave the new commandment, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. And we have Mahayana Buddhism that gave us the Bodhisattva vow to free all beings along with ourselves. Self and other are not two. And finally, in our efforts to bring about a life-sustaining society, the time has come for solidarity and inclusion. There's a place for everyone in what Joanna Macy calls the Great Turning, which we will get to tonight. It's not for us to judge another person's personal choices or critique the scale or efficacy of their actions. Nor is it actually helpful for us to do that to ourselves. As long as anyone shares our aspiration to bring about a life-sustaining society and is taking some action consistent with their own interests, abilities, conscience, and opportunities, we should welcome them as a kindred soul. It is up to each of us as individuals to decide for ourselves if we are doing all that we can to help, and if we decide we can do more, to find some humble form of bodhisattva activity to which we can devote ourselves. As individuals, we may not seem to have that much impact, but if every person contributes, we can create real change. So, you know, the one danger of talking about a topic like this is, you know, then people get the message somehow you're supposed to become an activist. Most of us don't feel a real affinity with that term. What does that mean? That means that we're going to have to do... they were asleep for a while. Now they've just woken up. You know, we're going to do demonstrations and protests. What does this mean? What am I going to do? But Joanna Macy really encourages us to expand the idea of what it means to be an activist. If you are acting in order to help bring about the life-sustaining society, you are an activist. So there are many different ways to do this, and there's just no point in... I don't know, there's just no point in guilt and shame. There's no point in comparison. So I think all we can do is to just, you know, open ourselves to the question, am I doing all that I can? Is there something more that I can do? Is there something more that I feel called to do? What might that be? So, all right. So, my hope is that going over this book will help us face the mess we're in without going crazy, which is the subtitle. But just as importantly, find a way to act. I believe most of us really do want to help. That we really do look in the world and we see the injustice and we see the greed and the destruction and it grieves us. It's more of a sense that there's nothing we can do, or we don't know how to prioritize, or how do we engage without getting burned out? How do we engage without getting discouraged or opening ourselves up to this sense of like huge obligation and overwhelm? Or so it's really more of a, you know, how can we respond than that we just don't want to. So this is from the book. I keep on saying it's Joanna Mainz Haven. She wrote it with John Stone as well, but I'll mostly just say, and this is Joanna Mainz Haven. Most books addressing global issues focus on describing either the problems we face or the solutions needed. While we touch on both of these, our focus is on how we strengthen and support our intention to act so that we can best play our part, whatever that may be, in the healing of our world. So, let's define active hope. So she said, the word hope has two different meanings. The first involves hopefulness, where our preferred outcome seems reasonably likely to happen. If we require this kind of hope before we commit ourselves to an action, our response gets blocked in areas where we don't rate our chances too high. The second meaning is about desire. When Jane was asked, this is a story she had told, when Jane was asked about what she'd like to have happen in the world, without hesitation she described the future she hoped for, the kind of world she longed for so much it hurt. This is the kind of hope that starts our journey. Knowing what we hope for and what we'd like or love to take place, it is what we do with this hope that really makes the difference. Passive hope is about waiting for external agencies to bring about what we desire. Active hope is about becoming active participants and bringing about what we hope for. Active hope is a practice. Like Tai Chi or gardening, it is something we do rather than have. It is a process we can apply to any situation, and it involves three key steps. First, we take a clear view of reality. Second, we identify what we hope for in terms of the direction we'd like things to move in or the values we'd like to see expressed. And third, we take steps to move ourselves or our situation in that direction. Since active hope doesn't require our optimism, we can apply it even in areas where we feel hopeless. The guiding impetus is intention. We choose what we aim to bring about, act for, or express. Rather than weighing our chances and proceeding only when we feel hopeful, we focus on our intention and let it be our guide. So, what does this have to do with Buddhism? I think I could come up with many different answers, but here's one. So from the beginning, Buddhism has focused on how to orient our own hearts and minds such that we aren't simply at the mercy of circumstances. So Siddhartha Gautama, who later became the Buddha, saw sickness, old age, and death, and asked the question, you know, is this just the human lot? Is there anything that we can do about this? Anything we can do about the suffering? And then after awakening, he taught the Eightfold Path. And one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path is right intention, or right resolve. So it's being resolved on renunciation, and that's of grasping after sensual pleasures in a way that leads to suffering for self and others, on freedom from ill will, and on harmlessness. So this is called right intention or resolve. So there are other aspects of the path, but each aspect of the path is pivotal. So right intention points to how Buddhist practice is a realignment of our own hearts and minds in a way that frees us and others from suffering and leads to beneficial results. So the Buddha described how we should observe within ourselves what happens when we entertain thoughts of desire, ill will, or harmfulness versus what happens when, you know, we maintain right intention and we entertain thoughts of renunciation, we abandon ill will and unharmlessness. And this is from a sutra. So when the negative thoughts or feelings have, quote, arisen in me, that leads to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to awakening. End quote. So in that sutta, the Buddha explains how if you really see how this kind of thinking, entertaining these thoughts, leads to suffering, they will subside. And he also talks about in that sutta, I forgot to pull out a quote, but it's like, if you make a habit of thinking about desire, ill will, harmfulness, that's what's going to predominate in your mind. Whereas if you make a habit of right intention, that's what's going to predominate in your mind. So Buddhism is very pragmatic. It asks, what works? Or what works the best or most reliably? We know hopefulness works sometimes when the outcome we want seems likely. But what about when things look dire or overwhelming? What about when we lack hopefulness? So if we look within, if we focus on our desire for things to be other than how they are, what happens? If we dwell on the ill will and harmfulness being enacted by others, if we nurture our own ill will toward those who are doing it, what happens? If we focus on the likelihood that everything is going to get worse no matter what we do, what happens? We feel worse and worse and less willing to face what's going on and depressed and stressed and sad or whatever. Desire to just numb out. But what happens if we focus on right intention instead? What if we nurture, give our time and energy to our aspiration to help beings? To our deep love for life, for nature, for people, to doing whatever we can. When we focus on our intention, regardless of the odds we face, is this just wishful thinking? Denial? It doesn't have to be. We can be fully aware of what's going on and still make this choice. So according to Buddhism, to a large extent, we create our reality, both internal and external. So that's one of the ways I see Buddhism backing up, relating to, inspiring this concept of active hope. So before I get on to her other aspects of her presentation, any thoughts or questions, reflections on this aspect?
I really like the connection that you made. I really like the connection that you made.
Oh.
With the Macy's active hope and the Buddha saying the intention is what makes the difference. It's amazing.
I bought the book and haven't started it yet. But I'm halfway through The Soul of Money, which despite its title and its main topic, isn't really necessarily about money that much. And it's really inspired me in a way. You sort of introduced this whole thing at the beginning to really, and I haven't done it yet, it's gone on in my head a lot, I just haven't sat down and done it yet, but to do what the author tries to get us to and what to do and what it sounds like John Macy tries to get us to do, which is visualize the way we want our lives to be. And then act that way. As opposed to what this very author did was try to live the life that everybody else was living, and that way I had to keep track of what you have because I had to have more, and on and on and on. As opposed to sitting back and saying, what do I really want? what kind of world do I want to live in? What kind of world do I want for my friends and my family? And now what do I need to change about the way I live now to move toward that? And that's what I heard coming out of your introduction as well.
Yeah, I think the method of, I mean, it's not like only Buddhism teaches this, but I feel like the central method of Buddhism is we have a choice. We have a choice about how we respond to things and how we relate to things, and that just that can make a huge, huge difference.
I feel like I understand that, and I feel like I've experienced that with like just shifting, like trying to focus on the positive things. But I am overwhelmed by hump, by and feel in despair about our and how we're destroying our environment. But I'm like so to the point where it's like hopelessness, mm-hmm. and I don't even know how to get out of it. So I think it's like, is how do you make that shift? What are the small steps? And maybe that's what the book is, helps you, you know, obviously the title, but what are the steps to get to where you feel like you're actually doing something and you feel like, yes, I'm doing a little bit of, it's like really, but it's, especially when you watch those nature shows, like it's just so depressing. And so I think I like, or, you know, just news or whatever, it's hard to get out of that despair, that hopelessness, and to find, I don't know, feel like you're doing something. I need like little, like, connect, what's the first step, what's this little step, and this step, and just to get out of it.
Yeah, she has a whole process, and, you know, part of it, she has something which we'll talk about next time, because in one sense, it's like, okay, well, that's great, active hope in theory, but just do it. Like, I feel like that was what attracted me to Buddhism, is in a way. I remember talking to my Christian teachers, and I was like, well, I don't believe, I don't have faith. You know, what can I do about that? They're like, you know, too bad, then you're not part of the club. I mean, you're just... So it's not enough to just kind of present some kind of ideal. We have to have a way to get there. So, I mean, she definitely talks about the support of others, her spiral of what she calls the work that reconnects is honoring our pain for the world. So really, like, kind of, which the chapters will cover, is really, I mean, first of all, it's kind of like mindfulness. We have to see what's going on first, and not, like I said, we probably, most of us know enough to necessarily delve into that more, but just recognizing our grief, recognizing how traumatic and scary. I mean, there's a new, like, official psychological diagnosis of ecological anxiety. Mm-hmm. There's, like, actually people suffering mental illness that is based on their fears about what's going to happen ecologically, and makes sense to me. Seeing with new eyes, so, you know, opening up these other ways of relating, trying them on, coming from gratitude, and then also going forth. And I said a little bit about this on I think the Sunday talk, about, apparently, many people tell about this story, and I can relate to it as well, of being able to break free of this sense of despair through action. Like, some action, and it's really difficult to decide what and how to make your choice and when to prioritize and whatever, but like I read this dialogue between Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and Greta Thunberg, who's the Swedish high school student who started skipping school and sitting outside the Swedish Parliament, and now, like, all over the world, internationally, there are kids skipping school on Fridays as a protest that the governments aren't doing more to address climate change, and said this is our future. She had this little sign next to her, actually, I have her on the wall over there, and she said, if you adults don't give a shit about my future, I don't either, so I'm not going to go to school. So, but she described, she was like really, really depressed, and like was diagnosed as having Asperger's, and then as selective mutism. She just stopped talking. So she's probably about 13 at this point, just stopped talking. And then she talks about in this interview with AOC that when she went to sit in front of that parliament, she just broke out of that. It was just that doing that action, which she had no idea that it was going to end up being significant, that's what started getting her out of this. So this is like, and then Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez had a similar story where she was feeling into a lot of despair, and it wasn't until she went to Standing Rock and witnessed those demonstrations that that her sense of empowerment, I guess, was awakened. And I don't know, since November 2016, I've gotten a whole lot more civically engaged than I ever was before. everything that I do helps me break out of that sense of disempowerment. So I think there's an element of that. There's an element of we really do have to put something into action if we're feeling in this kind of despair. Anyway, there's more to come. Yeah.
Question: I don't know if this is really directly related to this book, but one of the issues I grapple with is, my youngest kid is still too young, but the oldest one is 8, and I want her to know about this stuff, but I don't know. Like, I think people should be scared. This is a threat. Like it's not like this. I don't even know how I would call it ecological anxiety. It's, you're afraid of something that is truly a threat to, like, your existence, human existence, your well-being. But I don't want to like scare her to the point of it not being useful. I mean. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to your kids about this stuff?
I don't know. That is incredibly. Well, for one thing, if you haven't watched Greta Thunberg speak, have you seen her before?
I know her. I don't want you to hope. I want you to panic. That's what she said.
Right. Yes. Yes.
But that's not.
Right. No. I mean, not that she's not the direct thing that you give to the kids, but
yeah.
but in terms that, like, she did say, like, this is, yeah, I want you, this is a scary situation,
right?
But I did hear, I remember hearing, like, I don't know, there are, that's a, I think, I don't know, I think you'd have to just talk to other parents.
And probably
resolve this to some extent within your own heart, so you have some active hope to share.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I feel like I saw a good resource for that, but it was a couple of years ago, but I remember the guy's name, and I will look for it, and if I can find it, I'll share it.
That'd be great.
Because it's, my daughters are in their 30s, and I have the same question. Because they want to live in business as usual. They have tiny young children. And they're not ready to look it in the face.
Yeah.
My wife isn't ready to look it in the face either. And I kind of feel like I've always kind of known it's there, but I just kind of recently started to face it. It's kind of interesting. I was going to schedule a song set and see what we have anything. I think it might be good to have like some talks about climate change. Here we are.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a, I guess one thing that occurs to me, there is some wonderful, I mean, I don't know if you've gotten this book yet, but I mean, I really highly recommend it because there's some wonderfully positive things in here which aren't at all like Pollyanna denial kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But one of the things she points out is the timeline of human development and how, you know, if you looked at the whole history of the world in 24 hours, you know, humans are in like the last 5 minutes or something. And if you looked at the whole history of humans, the Industrial Revolution and this whole mess is in just the last few seconds. Now, we may run ourselves to extinction before we figure this out, but if you look at it in a longer time frame, it, I don't know, for me, I don't feel quite as much despair because I'm like, okay, you know, we haven't been here that long. We've really gotten ourselves into a big mess, but, you know, but it could be a long arc of development of human beings after this. We really change and we really adapt and learn. So that's another aspect that she presents is this sense of adventure, this sense of determination and adventure, that the great adventures always involve facing insurmountable odds. So in a way, we could say, you know, the time is now. We're the ones that are going to have to, you know, rise up and change things. So, I don't know. There's a certain way we can. I know for me, I am. I don't know. I'm feeling like my life is. Like everything's kind of coming into alignment, and the reason that I was born is coming up. Like I've been waiting all my life watching this pointless destruction, but nobody, only a fringe people cared enough to really do anything. And now things have started to get bad enough that people are going, you know, that there's as much talk about it and concern and a sense of urgency as there is huge. And I find it quite encouraging. I mean, this is a chance to change everything. It's like this is a problem of such magnitude that it requires a real meaningful change. And that change, I mean, if you look at all the possible ways that those changes could happen, almost all of them look good. Almost of them look like a positive change for greater justice, greater simplicity in our lives, greater valuation of that which doesn't require material resources, all of those kinds of things.
So I think that the children will never realize the enormity of it because their mind's just not going to be able to realize. So I think the way you see it, your kids are not going to see it in that way. When my kids were little, when my daughter was little, the neighbor girl and we were just starting to talk about extinction of animals, and they started a little club, just the two of them, Save the World, Love the World club. And we printed out little iron badges for them. And they would, you know, make brochures and send it out to the neighbors, you know, Save the World, Love the World. Well, so it was empowering to them. And that both of them now really strong young women, not that they don't despair, but like Greta, they do what they can, you know. One of them, Jenna, the girl across the street, I mean, she's in Cambodia right now, saving women from trafficking. Huh? I mean, I always remember. I said, Jenna, you're saving the world, loving the world. And I still got those badges. Yeah. They would subscribe. subscribe to ZooBooks, you know?
Yeah.
ZooBooks was like, I don't know if you know, it's still there. Well, it was book about an animal every month, and they would look at that, and I used to worry, you know, why am I doing, maybe they should just watch Disney or something, you know, it's really, but it was good. It was, because they're not going to get the whole picture, just a little bit. Oh, this cute little chimpanzee, okay, I'm going to save it, save the movie.
But that's, and actually that brings me to the next part, which is the three stories of our time. So, you know, Joanna Macy, you know, has been an activist and studied deep ecology and Buddhism for 50 years. So, you know, a lot of this is informed by what really, what she's heard from people and what works for people. So she said, there's three stories of our time. And just briefly, in any great adventure, there are always obstacles in the way. The first hurdle is just to be aware that we as a civilization and as a species are facing a crisis point. When we look at mainstream society and the priorities expressed or goals pursued, it is hard to see much evidence of this awareness. In the first chapter of this book, we try to make sense of the huge gap between the scale of the emergency and the size of the response by describing how our perceptions are shaped by the story we identify with. So these are the three stories, just briefly, this is in the introduction. The first of these, business as usual, the defining assumption is that there is little need to change the way we live. Economic growth is regarded as essential for prosperity, and the central plot is about getting ahead. The second story, the great unraveling, draws attention to the disasters that business as usual is taking us toward, as well as those it has already brought about. It is an account backed by evidence of the collapse of ecological and social systems, the disturbance of climate, the depletion of resources, and the mass extinction of species. The third story is held and embodied by those who know the first story is leading us to catastrophe and who refuse to let the second story have the last word. Involving the emergence of new and creative human responses, it is about the epical transition from an industrial society committed to economic growth to a life-sustaining society committed to the healing and recovery of our world. We call this story the Great Turning. The central plot is finding and offering our gift of active hope. There's no point in arguing about which of these stories is right. All three are happening. The question is which one we want to put our energy behind. The first chapter is about looking at where we are and choosing the story we want our lives to express. The rest of this book focuses on how we can strengthen our capacity to contribute to the Great Turning in the best way we can. So, just very briefly, the Great Turning story also has three aspects. And one of them is, as they frame it, holding actions, stopping, slowing the harm that has been done. So this is a lot of what we think of as kind of activism, you know, protest demonstrations, etc. But also creating and promoting life-sustaining systems and practices. So these are the alternatives to the business as usual, finding new ways. And then three, contributing to a shift of consciousness. For instance, seeing ourselves as interdependent or all in this together in some way. And part of this is like the example, the shift of consciousness when the first time that we saw a photograph of the whole planet, you know, and seeing ourselves as all part of one thing. So just briefly, what do these three stories have to do with Buddhism? We don't usually talk about adopting stories. We talk about dropping stories, dropping narratives. So in a way, this is just what works, but we teach that when we drop the stories, We see not two. We see interdependence. We see the life of Buddha increases with life. No life can be cut off. So when we see this, we know business as usual is operating in direct and destructive opposition to that underlying reality. And when we drop our stories, we also see emptiness or perceive emptiness. Nothing, no thing, person, idea, opinion, perception, or all of those things are empty of inherently existing, enduring self nature. All things are a karmic flow, an interdependent karmic flow. Therefore, we can't get caught in our conclusions about the great unraveling. To some extent, those are just ideas. We don't know. I mean, they have their usefulness as we plan, as we respond to things, but our perceptions of the world and the possibilities and the likelihoods, to some extent, it is all empty. And so our practice can help us not get stuck in that is inherently true. And the third story, the great turning, is the Bodhisattva's vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. I vow to free all the beings and all the delusions. Which is, of course, impossible. But that's not what matters. So, I've told this story before about the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, a myth that Avalokiteshvara was filled with such sorrow, wanted to save sentient beings. He was just so moved, tears, just at human beings suffering and the way that they perpetuated their own suffering. And he vowed to never give up working to alleviate their suffering. And the Buddha replied, if you wish to benefit all these sentient beings, you must be motivated by loving kindness and compassion. Do not be tired of this work. Do not give up. So Avalokiteshvara then vowed, from each and every pore of my body may I manifest Buddhas and Bodhisattvas according to the needs of all sentient beings. With these manifestations, may I liberate all sentient beings without leaving anyone behind. If I have self-clinging, may my head crack into pieces. So the Bodhisattva then worked tirelessly, helped large numbers of beings escape from suffering. So at some point he figures he must have reduced the number of suffering beings. So then he used his supernatural powers to look out over the world and realized there were just as many suffering beings. And he got discouraged. And he thought, I don't know. I don't think this is worth it. I should just work for my own release, my own liberation. At which point his head cracked into pieces because he had made the vow. And that was a selfish view. So he was able, despite that, to appeal to the Buddhas, who put him back together again. But this time they gave him 11 heads so he could look in every direction to keep track of all the suffering. And Avalokiteshvara asked, can I also have 1,000 arms and with an eye in the middle of each one to respond? So essentially that picture, I don't know if you've ever seen, of that kind of Avalokiteshvara with 1,000 arms and eyes and 11 heads, that's like because he was so overwhelmed by the suffering that the Buddhas had to give him those superpowers to cope. But that's the spirit of it. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Life is Beautiful. Mm. But, that's the story of like the midst of a concentration camp and a father wants to, preserve his son's heart, not have him be destroyed by this. So that's what he devotes himself to, is to preserving his son's innocence in the midst of this terrible circumstances. So, so there's more to be said about how we work with these stories, expanding our ideas of activism. But before I open it up, I will just throw something out there that you might want to come to or join. This Friday, July 12th, all around the country at 9 p.m., wherever the local time is, there's going to be demonstrations at like ICE detention facilities and various places and all kinds of different places. And as people are going to be bringing candles, and it's going to be a minute of silence and a candlelight vigil for all the migrants being imprisoned in inhumane conditions. And in Portland, there'll be one at Terry Schrunk Plaza downtown, one at the ICE Detention Center, 4310 South Ouse McAdam, which I believe Shintai and I are planning to go to, and apparently also 9 p.m. at the Hillsdale Food Carts, which I think some of you are kind of near there, the Hillsdale Food Carts. So if you look up Lights for Liberty online, you'll, these different events will pop up.
I'm going to be sitting with people in Santa Fe.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, on Friday. Yeah, it really is all over.
Mm. Where, do you know where?
At Upaya Sensen.
Oh, wow.
At 5:30.
And I think, I don't know, I mean, it sounded like also like people might just kind of show up in their yards with candles and stuff like that as well, so. I mean, and that's the kind of thing, it's like, I don't know. Yoju and I show up to a lot of demonstrations, you know, and I feel like that. You know, you don't have the delusion that like, okay, well, that's fixed. But I don't know. It you know, it can be encouraging. You know, little pictures of a priest doing this on social media, and people are a little inspired. We don't really know. And you know, there's Greta Thunberg, who's sitting outside the Swedish Parliament, ended up, you know, starting this whole movement, and we don't really know what the impacts. I mean, she easily could have done that for a couple weeks and nobody noticed, and that's it. I mean, that kind of stuff happens all the time. But just sometimes what we do, it's at the right place at the right time, and it has an impact that we don't realize. So, I mean, I realize that many of us, I don't know, many of you may be just thinking, like, how the hell can I add anything to my schedule? That really is, like, one of the first considerations that many of us have. Our lives are very, very full and busy. And that's kind of, I don't know. It is a valid question. Huh?
You're guilty. You're totally.
I know. I mean, you have kids too. I mean, I just can't imagine. But opportunities may show up. You know, there's like, I canvass my own neighborhood, knocking on my neighbor's doors, reminding them to vote when there's an election. You can, like, you know, make phone calls to your senators and tell them that you want them to, you know, vote for certain legislation. And I don't know, I've gotten involved in like sending, if there's a close election that might swing in another state, you can send, there's organized like sending postcards to help the person, you know, swing the election. And I don't know, there's all kinds of little, not little and not so little ways to do. And I don't know, for me, I've found I mean, doing those little things by yourself is something, but it really does help to connect with other people too. That's where the juice really comes from.
What was the name of the thing on Friday? Something?
Lights for Liberty.
Right on Friday, September 20th. Green Day does her thing, whatever. It's supposed to be like everybody. She's inviting everybody across the world to come out and work.
Yeah, it's a global strike.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So if anybody's able to like skip work, or I don't know what else. Maybe we're also like not going to go to stores or something. That would be really cool.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool if it was just like if you don't have to drive, if you don't have to shop, if you don't have to like any of those things. So I'm not sure exactly the details, but that's that could be really interesting.
I was thinking about your question about children, maybe this doesn't apply necessarily, but I feel like empowerment has to be a key point, because there's so much discussion about, oh, this is so horrible and there's nothing I can do, and there's so many forces that are disempowering, where it's like, you have to have a cell phone for work, and you have to be employed so you can pay your bills, because you have student debt, but then the mining and the practices that go into making that cell phone, you know, are necessarily not whole and not good. And it's like, if one, this is true, you're shooting yourself in the foot and you can't even see how. And so I feel like trying to focus on what you can do to be empowering, which may be certain forms of austerity or conservation, or maybe like, but celebrating what you can do and what the consequences of that are. Like trying to encourage certain actions, whether that be part of a food co-op, and celebrating that and saying, hey, this is great, this is the consequences of this. Or hey, let's walk there. Think of all the great things that are coming from this. You're avoiding all these things. So like, I feel like empowerment has to be part of the answer. And like what you can do and celebrate and feel good about, rather than like everything you have to feel about it.
No, I agree. I mean, certainly just sharing a bunch of despair.
Yeah.
It's not going to make me feel good. It's not going to make me good. It's not going to be productive. But yeah, no, I agree with you 100%.
And I don't know about you guys, but I mean, I'm really, I don't know. I know it's this cognitive dissonance, but I'm ready to stop being paralyzed by guilt because I participate in this society. I mean, that's what this great article that I read was just like, yes! Because, I mean, with the way that I've looked at it is like, I could spend all of my time and energy sewing my own menstrual pads, or I could participate in society and be a priest and or whatever else it is that we do. I mean, we would have to be completely off the grid. And if we were off the grid, we would be hanging on to some land in a selfish way, right? Like, what? There's no way. There's just, given the options that we have now, there's almost like no way to live completely purely. And in a way, I mean, the way that we work with our precepts acknowledges this. It's impossible to keep the precepts completely. And that should never make it okay to break the precepts. So all of these should always be, we should all remain conscious and kind of sad about the things that we are doing. But on the other hand, like not letting it disempower us. Not letting it, like, I'm not going to hide out in my house because, you know, I still have a car. Like, because then I'm not going to be of help to anybody.
I do like that you've pushed it past, like, this personal obligation to a systematic. Like, we need to really, like, I remember I had a friend who, like, suggested this, like, a year ago, and it just, like, opened my eyes. Mm. Like, this needs to be a systematic. This is a systematic issue, not like corporations and all of that is doing so much worse than what. I mean,
right.
Yes, we have our part, but really, it's not even comparable to what they're doing. So I think I really appreciate that.
And every one of us who does our utmost. I mean, I just bring my own bags into Winco, and then I just watch like plastic bags.
Yeah.
I was like, what? They did plastic bag ban, a statewide plastic bag ban.
When is that
start? Huh?
I I've gone back and forth with the city of Hillsborough about the bus that I get. There's an article written on NPR, are plastic bag bans garbage? And, you know, using plastic is terribly detrimental to the environment. But then when you look at the alternatives, they're even worse. So, like, you know, paper weighs a lot more than plastic. And, you know, you all have the gas from the trucks to carry the logs.
Uh-oh, this is exactly the kind of debate I didn't want to get into. Anyway, moving right along. Thank you all for coming.